Access number 29540, Mr. Norman Cole, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Cole?
I was born in Torquay, Devon, 31st of December 1922.
And could you tell us a bit about your family background?
Yeah, my mother and father were both very working class. My father was a grocer's assistant who had rather poor health due to World War I injury.
What had happened to him? Who was he
serving? Well, he was with the Royal Fusiliers in the Somme, and he had shrapnel go through his throat and come out through the side of his face. And he was actually left on the battlefield for dead. And a soldier passing by saw him move a bit, picked him up and carried him back. But the result was he never had full health, really, after that.
It affected him badly after the war.
Well, he just didn't have good health.
Did he speak about it, or did he...
No, never used to talk about it.
Did it affect him mentally, do you think?
I don't think so, no. It only in the sense it took away his confidence a lot. As I say, he was a grocer's assistant, and the firm he worked for in Torquay offered to give him a managership of a branch they had, and he couldn't face that. My mother said she would help him and do all the necessary work behind him, but he just couldn't cope with it. He didn't have the confidence in life, and I think that was really due to the war experience.
So he stayed as a grocer's assistant then?
Yeah. Now, well, he did until there was a trade union representative came to his firm, and this was a grocery shop in Torquay, quite a big one, and everybody who went to that meeting with the trades union representative had their salaries cut. And he went from £2.17 a week to £2.15 a week, keep a wife, himself and a child. And I said to him, you aren't going to stay there, no way. And for a short time he went to another grocer's shop, but I got him a job with the builder's firm I was
just
with.
Much later in life, though.
Later than what? Later than the...
Well, if you got him, you weren't a child at that time.
Oh, no.
No, this is... This,
yeah. No,
no. This is, I'm talking about when you were a child. He was still working then.
Yeah.
Was it a happy childhood? I mean, what do you remember?
Oh, yeah, very, very stable family, very happy family. Single child, that's the only child, but... Yeah, very happy.
And reasonably comfortably off for a working class background.
I think life was a struggle all the time.
In what way?
Financially. I know one thing that my mother was very conscious of. As her child, she never wanted me to go hungry. And she always made and had available bread pudding. There was always bread pudding on the table, so I would never say I was hungry.
What about clothing? Was she able to clothe you well?
Yes, quite normally, yeah.
So pretty well. Now, what about your education? Tell us about your education.
Well, I went to a comparatively small primary school in Torquay, one that's sufficiently small that they couldn't give any special education for those who were going to take the 11 plus exams. We were told there was little chance that any of us would actually past 11 plus because we couldn't get the training in the right direction on the right subjects. I just missed it. And I was the youngest person taking it, because being the 31st of December, I was the youngest one in the town taking the exam. And I just missed it, but I went to the central school that was that. That was like a second grade from exam results.
And how did you do there?
Very well. Yes, I did very well there.
What were the subjects you were best at or most interested in?
I would love to say history, but the lady we had taught by sort of remembering numbers and remembering names and didn't make it live at all. I was quite happy with the science and the practical subjects there. I like the woodworking, engineering and... geography, I like.
History from
itself. Well, I didn't like history, but it was taught in an uninteresting way. I wish which should have been taught in a more interesting way. Yeah.
What qualifications were you going for? I mean, was there a qualification you took?
Well, from school? Not from school. When I left school, there was...
So you'd leave at 14?
Yeah. I was offered a job with the local big coal and fuel merchants. But when I got there, I passed their exam, and they said, "How old are you?" I was 14. And they said, "Well, our principal is against school leavers at 14. Come back at any time when you're 16, you've got a job." But I didn't go back. There was an accountant, a one-man business. He was an Australian, an accountant. And he took me on and gave me half a crown a week pocket money, 12 and a half pence pocket money. Because normally you had to pay a premium, and my people couldn't afford a premium.
This is an apprentice or not?
Trainee, really. Yeah.
Trainee accountant.
Yeah.
And what did you? How did you take to the work?
It was interesting, but I mean, I wouldn't say I went overboard about it. You know, there was no practical side to it, really. It was just really mathematical and, you know, sort of that theoretical side, a lot of it, doing the books for different companies and that, checking their invoices and that.
And you were doing that, what, from 1935 to...
No, not all that long, because he decided to go back to Australia. And he was a teacher at the local technical college, teaching accountancy. And the local building firm, one of the bigger firms in Torquay, wanted an office boy. And he recommended me for this job. And I went to this firm called Vanstone & Sons, and they employed me as in their office. Didn't have a title of office boy, but just obviously junior in the office. And that I was interested in, because that was building. I remember going for the interview up through the main street in Torquay, and I remember walking down through the main street in Torquay. When I went up, I didn't see much. When I was walking down, I saw all sorts of building work going on that I'd never noticed before I had a job in the builder's office.
Now, what year did you start there then? You were at the accountant in 1935, I suppose.
I would have been 14. Yeah, I'd have been 36 when I...
When you went to the building firm?
When I went to the building firm. Probably 15 when I went there.
It isn't much, you know. Now, tell us a bit about your work as an office boy.
To start with, I mean, I had to do all the checking wage sheets and time sheets and things like that. But there's a separate office just in a little corridor in the building where their one and only surveyor worked. And I found I was more and more interested in what he was doing. And as a result, I started to go to the night school at the technical college and did the course on building subjects. And after a while, I went into the boss and said, you know, can I please be transferred into the surveying office there? Because that's what I'm doing as a study, and that's what I'm interested in. And that's what he did. I was transferred into there, yeah.
As a trainee surveyor. Now, what was that like? Tell us a bit about your work there.
It was interesting. I was just going out with the surveyor most of the time, holding the other end of the tape when he was measuring. But it was practical. It was building, and I found I really took to that. I used to get good marks, too, in the subject.
Now, that's what you were doing until the war started. Now, did you have any big hobbies or interests outside of before the war broke out? I mean, were you a member of the Boy Scouts or any big hobbies?
Oh, I was always a member of the Boys Brigade.
Now, tell me about what sort of activities did you do with the Boys Brigade? Because they can be quite military in time. What do you remember the sort of thing you did with them?
Well, the thing I talk most about now is discipline. The whole atmosphere was very disciplined, and I liked the subjects. I mean, did first aid and wayfaring and things like
that. Wayfaring being?
Similar to scouting, really. All about the countryside and finding your way around and reading maps and so on. Yeah, I find that interesting.
Did you go away on camp?
No, I didn't then. I didn't then.
And was the family religious? I mean, did you come from your church? Which church were you members of?
Well, my father was really from a Baptist church, but we got more involved with a Pentecostal church. That became our normal church, Pentecostal, yeah.
So you were quite religious at the time, yourself, or was it the family were?
Well, I was to a degree. I mean, I'm not sure I understood everything at that time, but yes, I would have wanted to go to church regularly.
Now, were you aware of the approach of war at all? I mean, did you follow politics, things like that?
Yes, I was always fairly well read. I was quite aware of what was going on. And I always remember my mother and father together saying, thank goodness this war will be over before our boy's old enough to go into it. Because in those days they thought it was going to be a very short, sharp thing, didn't they? And it wasn't.
Now, what do you remember? Were there any signs of preparations? Because you were in a building.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a big thing. This is one of the biggest thing, really, before I went in the forces, because this firm that I was with, Vanstone's, jointly had a contract in Plymouth, and it was to protect the oil fuel tanks, which were the major supply of oil fuel for the Navy. And they used to travel down from Torquay, and I lived in Paignton at the time, we used to travel down regularly with the workmen and that. And we were building a brick skin around the outside of these oil fuel tanks with a gap between the brickwork and the tank itself. And that was filled in with concrete. So there's quite a thick barrier around the tanks if they should be bombed. And this was given what was then called a war cabinet priority. And we understood there was only one other job in the whole of the country that had war cabinet priority. And the outcome of that was, if we said, with all the shortage of men, if we said we wanted 10 bricklayers tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, there was 10 bricklayers. If we said we wanted 20 tons of cement tomorrow morning, 20 tons of cement arrived. Shortages meant nothing. The war cabinet priority, because of the importance of the oil to the Navy.
And this was started before the war broke out.
Yeah.
And that's it. Where was that at?
It was started...
it says thanks, Tor Point.
Yeah, it was thanks, Tor. I don't think it started before the war broke out. I don't think so. When war broke out, taking it back a sec, when war broke out, I was sent out by my firm to a lot of the hotels in Torquay.
Yeah, because we're jumping about a bit now. So tell me about the day war broke out, the old joke if you like, but what do you remember about the day war broke out?
I was called, and that's a point I just come to now really, I was, by the firm, I was given the job of going around to these hotels one day before the war broke out.
Right.
Measuring all the windows for blackout screens. They obviously knew war was coming. And I was going through these hotels, measuring every window to get these blackout screens made.
For all the big local hotels?
Yeah. Yeah, because they were going to be taken over by the Royal Air Force, which we didn't know at the time, but that was the plan. And did happen eventually.
And then the day war broke out, did you hear the broadcast? Do you remember?
Yeah.
What do you remember of that?
Just remember hearing it, and didn't really sort of, the implication as far as I was concerned didn't really hit me. I thought too it'd be all over before I was old enough to be called up for the forces, but I wasn't.
Now, so then you go on to this business of providing the splinterproof skins. That's when that happens.
That's right.
That's not a problem. So what do you remember about that work? I mean, did you move into Plymouth or
no,
did you travel?
No, we travelled down every day. The manager of the firm used to pick me up in Paignton, because I lived in Paignton, and take me down by road. We were there working away when the Plymouth Blitz took place. And in point of fact, there was... as we were going down the day before the Plymouth Blitz, as we were going into Plymouth, there was a line of fire engines and ambulances the day before the Blitz. They obviously knew it was coming. They were from all over the country, from Norwich and Peterborough and all sorts of places.
Do you remember the date of the Blitz? They can look it up.
No, I can't. But when the Blitz took place, the next morning we were going down there to do our job, and we were met on the way down by a motorcyclist, a military one, who stopped us. He obviously knew the car we were travelling in. He stopped us and said we were to follow him because we'd never get through the roads. And he took us through bypasses and that, actually into the dockyard. And at the dockyard, we went across the river to Thanks in the Admiral's barge. The job was so important and such a high rating that they were determined that we would be there and the job would carry on. And we were taken over there. But in fact, the fuel oil tanks did get hit. Two of them were set alight. And
what do you remember of that?
Well, work had to stop, of course. There was black smoke everywhere. These fire engines came, and a few of us volunteered to help lay out the pipes, you know, for the firemen, the actual water
hose pipes,
couldn't think of the word. Most of the workmen sat in the buses. I don't know how many of them got out. But I remember when I went home that evening, my mother saying afterwards, she said, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry because your face was black, your clothes were black. The next day when we went down, there were men from the ministry there with money in their hands. And we had to tell them what we'd lost as a result of that. Of course, even the labourers all lost a complete set of expensive tools and so on. I only claimed for my suit.
Now, what were the fires like? How bad were the fires?
Oh, they were bad.
Two tanks caught fire,
yeah. Yeah. And they were isolated. There was high banks built around, earthen banks built around each one or two tanks, so it didn't spread all that far. Well, the oil came out, it was contained by these surrounding banks. But they were burning for a couple of days. But that evening we had a meeting in our office of some of the military people of the area. And they used our office to do their discussion on how they would try to prevent the Germans being able to come with spotter planes and see where the fires were and then bomb into it again. And they were talking, I remember talking about putting up balloons to protect the site and that.
And why were you at that meeting, if you see what I mean?
Well, it was our office. We kept going.
And whilst we were... on in the background?
Yeah, and whilst we were there, two of our workmen came back with a man who claimed he was deaf and dumb. Couldn't speak. They found him interfering with the oil controls down on the site, so they brought him up. And we kept him there. He claimed he couldn't speak. Well, whether that was true or not, I don't know. And we kept him there until some naval ratings came. They took him away. He was clearly interfering with the system then there.
So it was presumed he was some sort of spy or saboteur?
Saboteur, I think.
Now, anything else about your work there? It sounds, I mean, it's quite important work, obviously, for the Navy.
There's little incidents. I mean, I remember one Scottish fellow came one evening asking for a job, and he was drunk. And there was two steps up into the office. And he was so drunk, he couldn't get up the steps. And he was told if he came back sober in the morning, he'd have a job. He came back sober in the morning, and he became our best bricklayer. And, of course, they were working around these big tanks. And the others had to work harder to keep up with him. He was so good. He was invaluable to us. And another little incident was one of the ratings down there, further down the site, had cut his wrist badly. Obviously, he'd cut an artery. And he brought him, and I had the first aid kit there because I was always interested in first aid following the boys' brigade. And I put a dressing on this, put a tourniquet on his arm, took him to a doctor that we'd made arrangements with, and he explained to me how I could get him across to the hospital in Plymouth. And we got him over there, and they say, okay, he'd be okay. They treat him.
Now, there's a story about your girlfriend at the time, Gwen.
When we got caught up on Wall's Hill.
Well, tell us the whole story.
Well, it was one evening. We'd obviously had tea, I suppose, at home, and went for a walk around the coast. And in Torquay, there's this grassy headland, Wall's Hill. And we were cutting across that on our way home. And we were in the middle of Wall's Hill, and we suddenly were challenged. Halt, who goes there? And it was a member of the Home Guard there doing his duty, sort of. He told us we had to go with him down to his office. They had a hut, which we were using as a local office. And we had to go down there and explain who we were and why we were on Wall's Hill.
Was that a restricted area?
No, not at all. And to this moment, I don't know why we were stopped. I mean, he asked us who we were and what we were doing. And so after we told them, a bit of a laugh all round, and we went on our way and went home.
Now, anything else you remember from this period? Well, one thing, did you have any sort of shelter or anything in your home? Where were you then? Paignton, you said?
Yeah.
Was there an air raid shelter or any precautions there, blackout precautions, for your own home?
Oh, blacked out, yes, you had to black out.
And how was your house done?
Just with black curtains. We had bought black material. And
nothing complex,
then? No, not at all.
What was it like? I mean, with that work, you must have had to drive about at night. What was it like in the blackout?
Well, when you say drive, I was riding a bicycle in those days. You had to have a light, which was so obscured that the light only went down in front. And living in Paignton, working in Torquay, down by the Grand Hotel in Torquay one evening, I was knocked off my bike by a car. And I wasn't badly hurt, but tried to walk, and I got as far as one of the hotels, about another quarter of a mile on, and I couldn't walk anymore and went in there. And there was a man there, though petrol ration was very strict, he volunteered to take me home in his car. And so it was difficult getting around then because of the lack of
What about when you were getting lifts to and from Plymouth? Some of them would be at night, wouldn't they, in the winter?
Yeah, some of them would be. I mean, I've got no recollections of going in the dark, because we used to go down in the morning, and we wouldn't have been in, because we'd finished work, you see, in daylight.
Right, okay.
Wouldn't be work. There was no floodlights or anything like that.
Anything else you remember about this period before you were called up?
Can't think of anything in particular.
You didn't join anything? You weren't a member of the Home Guard or
there is one important thing, my dear wife there. When I was studying, because my studying was going on all this time, and the building course, I got to a point where I couldn't sleep. I was so keen on my surveying work in that. My mind wouldn't switch off, and my mother made me go to the doctor, and he said I had to find an outside interest. I looked in the local paper, and there was going to be a roller hockey game. So I thought, well, I'll go and watch that. But before the roller hockey game started, there were people there in this hall just skating around on roller skates. And I thought, that's what I'll have a go at. So I bought some skates and went there. And down the side of the hall, there was a handrail about a metre and a half from the wall. So beginners went there, and if you fell, you had a handrail, you could grab hold of the wall. My wife always claims that she fell over in Mug's Alley, and I picked her up, and that's how she met me. That was how I met my wife. I'm picking her off the floor.
Did you plan to get... I mean, did... In those days, when you met someone like that, you see from your memoirs, you were quite keen on each other. But you say there was no long-term future. Did people not think of getting married before?
Well, this was a religious matter. You know, I had a very free church type, Pentecostal church, and she was a very ardent Roman Catholic. And the two, in those days, not so much now, but in those days, they were very different and they had very different beliefs and attitudes. And before the war, we met just really skating and a couple of times, I think, outside. I can't remember exactly what. And she invited me to go back to her home, and she was, because she went in the ATS. That's a picture of her up there. She went in the ATS, and the day she was going off to the ATS, she invited me back to her house to have a farewell meal with the family. And that was the next step in our relationship. But then the war came. We didn't see each other until after the war. I know that's a jump, but
no, I understand.
After the war, I came back. I'll come to that later on, because there's a story behind that even.
Oh, we'll do that. Now, so the next thing sounds like it's your call-up. Now, that looks like, well, partly in February 42 is when you actually go. What about that? What was the call-up process, if you could describe?
Well, I couldn't be called up whilst I was on this war cabinet priority work.
So you had a reserved, it was counted as a reserved occupation. I was thinking it would be.
Yes, I...
What did you think of that? I mean, were you inclined to stick to that? Or?
Oh, yes, I enjoyed the work. I thoroughly enjoyed being there working on the site.
So how come you stopped being reserved occupation? Because they do call you up, don't they?
Yeah, because the job was running out. The job was finishing.
And they didn't need any more of that kind of
thing? No. No, I mean, I was only reserved for that job. As the job was running out, my reservation ran out.
So once the oil tank contract was completed?
Virtually.
Now, what was the call-up procedure? What do you remember? How exactly did they go about calling you up?
Sending a notice telling me to report to the castle in Exeter for military service. Well, I went there and was interviewed by different people, representatives of different services. I mentioned in there that at that time the old Swordfish planes had made their attack on the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau, and I was really thrilled at that, and I wanted to, stupid, isn't it? I wanted to get in and never go, so I wanted to volunteer for the Fleet Air Arm, and they told me I couldn't do that. I had to make a first choice, I think it was the Air Force, and second choice Navy, or I could have done it the other way around, which I did do, and when they called me up, of course they called me up into the Army, which was sensible as it turned out.
Now, what about, was there a medical of any?
Yes.
How strict was it? Because you know they can vary from almost nothing to.
I don't remember it being terribly strict.
Any intelligence or tests or anything like that? Or was it just.
No, not so much.